Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
If you're the sort of Totally listener who's ever wondered to yourself, this Totally Football show makes for a really excellent podcast three times a week, but what if it was available in book form? Then you are in luck. The Totally Football Yearbook is the definitive chronicle of this season that's coming to its climax, and it'll look absolutely ravishing on your bookshelf or indeed in your bathroom. There's a foreword from Jamie Carragher, plus features and club-by-club season reviews, stats, quizzes and expertise from our chums at The Athletic and your Totally favourites like Daniel Storey, Rafa Honigstein, Duncan Alexander, James Horncastle and Julien Laurent. The Totally Football Yearbook is out on August the 5th and you can pre-order your copy wherever you get your books today.
Totally Football Show. Today, Champions League. Wednesday, Parisians losing their heads like it's the tale of two cities. And in many ways, it was a tale of two cities. Worst of times, and then the best of times for Pep's side. Meanwhile, for Chelsea, will that 1-1 in Madrid be enough? And was Werner's the worst finish for a sitter since Damien's nanny in The Omen? We digest the semi-final action, then look ahead to the weekend with big games everywhere from Newcastle to Old Trafford. All that plus epic drama in the Intertotally as Horncastle faces Lorient. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Good day to you, good listener. Here we are, Thursday morning, 29th of April. Big day, by the way, for football anniversaries. We'll touch on those later on. In the company, though, today of Duncan Alexander. Hello, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Hello to you. Jack Lang is also with us. Hello, Jack.
Good morning.
And also, live from his office at Rochdale AFC, David Preece.
Good morning. Can I just say that that's a wonderful haircut, that.
I think you're talking to Duncan.
I am talking to Duncan.
Right.
That's the first time anyone employed by Rochdale has complimented my hair, as far as I know, and I like it.
I'm only a temporary fixture here, so it's...
So is hair, in many ways.
Would you like to describe Duncan's haircut for those who are not present on our Zoom call?
Very shorn. I think it's complemented very well by the large spectacles as well. It's a very, very strong look.
To me, he looks like a kind of tech entrepreneur who's maybe lining up a billion-dollar bid for a Premier League club or something crazy like that. David, lovely to hear. Congratulations about your position there at Rochdale, although you say it's only temporary, but particularly so after your keeper conceded three midweek at Wimbledon.
Yeah, they weren't all his fault, though. It was just an arrangement that suits us both. I think they were... They need the goalkeeping coach. The goalkeeping coach left sort of with 9 or 10 games left to go in the season. And I was available and got a phone call from Brian Barry Murphy, who's a manager here. And it's worked out great. And of course, they were in a bit of a predicament before I came in. And they've actually given themselves a fighting chance of still getting out this with two games to go. So it's been a great experience just being here. And I can see definitely that... you know, not knowing much about Brian before I came in as well. He's somebody with a massive future in football. You know, he's done a great job here on a limited budget, playing some great football as well, very brave football. And I'm a bit disconsolate after the other night because it was a 97th minute equaliser after Jay Lynch, goalkeeper, saved a penalty as well. And it would have been a massive, massive result for them. But yeah, it just makes things a little bit hard for the last two games.
All right, 4 points from safety. You're in the bottom four of League One. Sorry, who's the weekend's game against?
We've got Doncaster home on Saturday, and then it's MK Dons away, the last game of the season.
All right, huge fixtures. Now, also midweek, alongside Wimbledon Rochdale, was the Champions League semi-finals. Man City in Paris, putting in one of their best second halves ever. Some have described it as, and coming away with a 2-1 victory. from the Parc des Princes. Chelsea, meanwhile, returning from Madrid on Tuesday with a point and an away goal after the 1-1 there at Valdebebas. Intriguingly, both sides playing without a recognised striker. Let's talk City first.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Le pied gauche de Mahrez, le pied droit de Kevin De Bruyne. Navas est prêt à bondir, c'est pour Mahrez, c'est pour Riyad Mahrez. Le scénario catastrophe au Parc des Princes. Riyad Mahrez vient plomber les espoirs de qualification du PSG.
Paris Saint-Germain 1, Man City 2, and it was very much a bout de souffle Wednesday night in Paris. Breathless stuff. Paris Saint-Germain bossing it in the first 45 minutes. More PS5 than PSG, I felt, Neymar at times. But then City completely taking over. In fact, the shot count's remarkable. 9-4-2 PSG in the first half, 7-1 to Man City in the second. What happened?
Kind of hard to explain. It's the kind of game you look at your notes after it and half of them just seem completely irrelevant. And it's tempting, I think, because it's more recent, just to look at the second half as the one that defines the game. But it really was a stark contrast between the two halves, I thought. I thought PSG were really good in the first half. Didn't really give City much time to settle. And, I mean, I struggled to see tactically anything City did too much different in the second half. I think it was just a bit more intensity. They got in PSG's face a bit more. And I think maybe PSG were a bit passive themselves. Probably justifiably thought that with a lead, maybe inviting City onto them wouldn't be that bad a ploy, because then they'd be able to hit on the break. But they didn't really carry any threat. And yeah, just the momentum shift was fairly remarkable, really. I think it's an open question why City couldn't play that way in the first half, given how dominant they were in the second.
Well, they were against an extremely confident PSG in that first 45 minutes. The kind of popular take Wednesday night was, though, that the Parisians very much bottled it in the second.
Well, I think it was a rare game of three halves. You don't get many of those, in the sense that for the first 10 minutes, and I think it's been a little bit forgotten, City were very in control. They completed tons and tons of passes, but they didn't really do much with it other than one Bernardo Silva chance. And then PSG got a foothold. There was a couple of missed tackles in midfield by City, and that really sort of, you know, spurred Neymar, Di Maria particularly, and Mbappe slightly less so on. And then they were really hanging on for the rest of the half. And it, as you said earlier, it was some of the most breathtaking football we've seen all season or for a long time from PSG. But then, you know, if there's one manager I guess you want to have in the dressing room at half time to turn things around, it is probably Pep Guardiola.
I think the best performance of the tie was Pep Guardiola pre-match, because I think a lot of people, when it comes to this time of the year and this stage of competition, especially Champions League, we know what Guardiola's like. He's intense, you know, he tries to overthink things. And I think we all thought he was just, pre-match when he's talking about it, just enjoy it, talking about the quotes from Johan Cruyff, that's, you know, at this stage of the competition, you just got to enjoy things. We all thought, yeah, it's all rhetoric. But actually, it's what's brought them through in the end. You know, it's the first time in a long time I've seen Manchester City players stressed like they were in the first half by an opposition, by the press and the intensity of the opposition, but they weren't panicked. And I think that's, you know, a lot of the cases, managers' personalities and the way that they are translates onto the pitch. You know, you look at people like Klopp and Simeone and the way their teams play. But with Pep this time, he took the right course of action in the beginning, before the game. Just be calm. It's not be all and end all, and it's a quarter it's half of a tie. So it's not all finished in this game, so we don't have to panic too much. And it's exactly what happened, especially second half. Yeah, it's so intense the first half. It was all 1-2 touch passing because both teams were pressing so hard. And it wasn't until the second half when City can take 2, 3, 4 touches and have more sustained attacks that they took over in the second half. And a lot of that was, like I said, down to the mentality of the manager.
I think actually the substitution of Cancelo for Zinchenko actually, for me, shaped things more in the final stages than you might expect a substitution of one fullback for another to do, because Cancelo has a slight tendency to play a bit more slowly. He likes to take a touch, move inside. Very good player. But Zinchenko, just staying a bit further left, let Foden roam a bit more. There were more combinations. You saw City's attackers switch positions a lot more in the second half, I thought. And, you know, Foden being able to come in off the wing with Zinchenko there, I thought made a fair bit of difference, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say Foden, I think, was the key switch in some ways. And you look at his touch map for the first half, and they're nearly all right on the left flank. And a lot of his passes were backwards. He looked a little bit overawed. Obviously, he did have one touch in the box, which was that really good chance towards the end, which he kind of hit straight at the keeper. But you look at the second half, and they're nearly all in the middle. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk this season about City playing without a striker and a false nine. And I think it works. It's been proven to work, but I think it doesn't really work that well when Kevin De Bruyne does it. And he didn't look great at it in the first half. And him dropping back a bit in the second half and Foden kind of going into that position looked much more dynamic. And I think that was one of the key changes.
Mm. Well, City coming back from being 1-0 down at half-time in consecutive away Champions League knockout games, which is especially curious given that they almost never do that in the Premier League. They've only achieved it, in fact, once in the last 105 Premier League games, a run dating back to 1995. There is, as I say, it was described by some as one of the all-time great second-half performances by City or by an English club in Europe. The counter-argument to that I've seen expressed as well, which is that if Verratti wasn't so short and if PSG had a competent keeper, then it would have been a very different scoreline. Let's talk about De Bruyne's equaliser there. David, how much is Keylor Navas to blame for that, and how much was it just the perfect delivery?
I think it's more about respecting the delivery of the ball rather than anything Keylor Navas could do with it. There was a lot of people saying that it's a mistake. Even on TV last night, they were saying mistake by Keylor Navas. But if you look at it, you have to look at these things from a keeper's point of view, from his own eyes. And when you look at from where the balls came in, it hasn't travelled a long way. This isn't sort of the ball that's come out wide where you've had plenty of time to take a look at it. He's played the ball in fairly low. So when it reaches its optimum height, that's he's only managing to see the ball for a split second to make that decision that he's going to come for it. The ball's not high enough over the top of the oncoming players to make that decision. His initial decision just to stay and set and wait for a header coming in or possible header coming in is the correct one. And then by the time the ball clears them and bounces into the six-yard box, it's too late for him to recover. And it would be easy to say that his sole focus should be on the ball, but that's not the way that sight happens, especially in game in team sports like this. Your sight is always distracted by the moving objects in front of you as well, so it's impossible to keep that sole focus on the ball. And again, he just doesn't get a long enough look at it. What is it like? Between 25 and 30 yards away that De Bruyne puts the ball in from. And from the hip leaving his foot till it reaching his optimum height, he probably doesn't see a lot of that ball anyway. And everything he does in that situation is the correct thing to do. If his option is to guess where the ball's going, a lot of the time he'll get caught out in situations like that.
So certainly by the time the ball has reached that kind of danger zone where Stones and Gundogan are coming in, he clearly can't commit to that, or he's waiting to, he's anticipating a header from them, and that's why he doesn't make the move. But should he not have attacked the ball before that? You're saying he didn't have time to get across to the ball before that?
I don't think there's enough air on the ball and enough time for him to make that decision. You'd be in the realms of guessing and rather than anticipation. And I think that I was listening to the radio this morning, and I won't mention the pundit, but they were saying, well, you know, the ball's well over the head of the defenders and the strikers. It's at least 6 inches. You know what I mean? In those situations where there's lots of dynamic movement in front of you and there's lots of different decisions for you to make, 6 inches is nothing. And like I said, for the time where the ball reached high enough for him to see the ball, there's not enough time for him to react to and make a decision to come for the ball.
And a brilliant little bit of spin on the ball as it touches just to then curl inside the post. Lovely delivery from Kevin De Bruyne, whatever his intentions was. Let's talk then about the second goal for Man City. Mahrez's free kick. Adam Rodriguez says, can you ask David Preece if there's anything more frustrating as a keeper than having a defensive wall part like the Red Sea? If they had just jumped straight up, ... says Adam.
It's criminal. It's absolutely criminal. And even when Pochettino was asked after the game, he didn't really comment that much on it, but you can see he was fuming with it. And so you would be. And then you get... Because we've moved into a time now where we are analysing keepers more, and I've said this in so many occasions, where sometimes the analysis is just, can we criticise the goalkeeper? Can we, you know, can the keeper be at fault here? So I've seen people say, oh, well, you know, could have Navas done something about it? He'd done well just to get even near it with the ball coming through the wall. And you're right, so much detail is put into football these days, especially in set-piece situations, where you have a lot more control over what you do, even defensively. And you're putting draft excluders under the wall to stop it from going there. You don't have to worry about that. All you literally have to do, like the tweet says there, you just have to move up and down.
Is the one thing that's more frustrating for a keeper than having a defensive wall part hearing people who haven't been keepers doing punditry on goalkeepers?
I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but as long as they appreciate that probably a goalkeeper themselves can put a better spin on it.
Mm.
At least we now know why players, the draft excluder, faces their own goal, because you get a really real-time view of it going in. It looks quite the horror on the face. Just one other thing on keepers, actually. It was good to see Edison take a throw-in at one point in the game, which is a relatively rare action from a goalkeeper. A nice tribute to Joe Hart in the BT studio, who's the only keeper to make three throw-ins in a single Premier League game. So that
is
was
that
a nice
right?
Touch.
All right.
Mm. Guess the game. It's pretty obvious. Game where City were having to pile on pressure to score maybe two goals.
QPR?
Yeah.
Jack, where was that form in the intertotally?
Well, yeah, quite...
Anyway, two unusual goals then for City, but they deserve enormous credit for the way that they reacted to being under the cosh from PSG in the first half. How over is this? A comeback looks unlikely, perhaps, but then City making a comeback look pretty unlikely at halftime of this one. Miguel Delaney pointing out that the last manager to overturn a Champions League first leg home defeat to go through was Pochettino.
One of only two to do it at this stage. I mean, we should probably call out just how good City have been. That was their 18th away win in a row in all competitions. They're the first English team to win six European Cup or Champions League games in a row since the 1960s. You know, they're just in incredible form. But I think it's still really poised really well for the second leg, because it doesn't really change, you know, it's the cliches, and it doesn't really change PSG's task. But they're set up to... for an away game at City in many ways. They didn't really lose anyone to suspension or injury apart from Ghana, obviously.
Right. Well, that could be quite big. And also, I'm slightly surprised to hear that it doesn't change PSG's task, conceding two away goals.
But I think, you know, they went to Old Trafford and won 3-1 this season. I don't think the way they set up is necessarily going to be impacted by the fact they're away from home compared to in Paris. So, yeah, I think it's still a pretty dangerous situation from City. But they do, as David said earlier, they do now. They feel like they've come to a point in their careers where they can cope with this pressure, which I think they haven't been able to on numerous occasions.
Equally, it'll require a real show of character from a PSG. And if there's been one question about PSG over recent years, it's been character.
Yeah, you would hope that the Pochettino factor would galvanise them there, I suppose. And last year's run, they did have moments of difficulty as well. Obviously, we know that over the years, there's a back catalogue of quote-unquote bottling. But I think last night was interesting because you could see that they'd been kind of shaken a bit by how City came back into it. And they did slightly... they didn't lose their nerve, but certainly lost their cool, like Gay's tackle, obviously. But it was Gay also who gave the free kick away for Mahrez's goal. A very needless hack at Foden, and you had Paredes kicking the ball away. I think they have got a number of players who play close to or on the edge, which when things are going well is very good. But yeah, I think they will need to be careful. You know, if things don't go their way from the start, in Manchester. I think they will need to steady themselves and not get into that slight spiral which some of their players can go into.
You do wonder how much of that can be laid at Pochettino a little bit. You know, his teams in his career have had the tendency to... I mean, we're coming up for 5 years since the Battle of Stamford Bridge, where they essentially did what Gay did in that game many, many times, but didn't get a red card. So,
but Ajax, Duncan.
True. But, I mean,
and
if we
Man
can get
City
a game...
the round before that.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. If we can get a game as good as the Man City-Tottenham game at the Etihad that year in the second leg, then it's going to be an all-time classic.
Let's see. Just before we leave this question from Steve C, who says, does Duncan know if Marquinhos is the first player to score against two clubs from the same city in the same Champions League season? Duncan.
No, it happens relatively often, actually. Serge Gnabry did it against Chelsea and Tottenham. Peter Crouch did it against Inter and Milan in 2010.
Well, then he won't remember that.
He won't know. Steven Gerrard did it against Atletico and Real Madrid in 08-09. Lewandowski's also done it against Atletico and Real Madrid in 16-17. And they're the only kind of city combos that actually looked up and then thought, actually, it's probably more common than people think.
Harry, is there any truth in the rumours that you're off to Spain in the summer?
Sorry, me no hablo inglés.
What about one of the Manchester clubs?
Well,
Harry, what about my source who says you're keen to stay at Spurs?
Can we keep the questions sensible, please?
Kane's future at Spurs remains uncertain, but you're guaranteed to get money back as a free bet if one leg of your fourfold acca lets you down. Paddy Power.
Max free bet £10, min odds 1-5 on each leg. Online exclusive, exclude shop bets and enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Let's move on to Tuesday night's clash, which was Real Madrid 1, Chelsea 1. Two brilliant goals here. What do you think about these? David Pulisic and then a Benzema.
Well, Pulisic is a great bit of individual skill and he's kept a real cool head in his finish when, especially when taking past Courtois, but also Benzema's goal coming from a corner and Marquinhos' goal coming from a corner just shows out even you know at this level how much is put into set pieces these days and how valuable they are. I mean, especially when you've got players who can literally put the ball where they want them to, almost every free kick and corner is a goal scoring opportunity. So. Yeah, it showed the value of that as well. But I've been really impressed with Thomas Tuchel just because since he's come in, people have been levelled an accusation that it's been a bit boring, it hasn't been exciting. But what he's done, he's made sure that Chelsea control games. You know, he's played this 3-4-3 system, which I think is great. You know, playing with a false nine quite often leaves central defenders redundant. They don't know what to do, and sometimes they get pulled out of position. And because, like I said, they'd be more happy if they were up against a striker of Giroud or Abraham, and it makes their job easier what they want to do. But also, like I said, it's about controlling the games, and they've done that brilliantly. And they've got the best of both worlds. You know, when they're in possession and they're keeping the ball, then it's perfect. Of course, they can control the game there, but they control the game on transitions as well. And the front three that they've got, we can go on about Werner and how he's been misfiring. He should be scoring a lot more goals, but just the sheer threat of him, you know, alters the way that teams can play against them.
Right. I mean, that was next on my agenda to go on about Werner. He should be scoring more goals, but only because that's what Thomas Tuchel says on the weekend after his miss against West Ham. It was kind of put to the Chelsea manager that his work rate and the amount of other things he contributes to the team means that basically we should all cut Timo some slack. And Tuchel was having none of it. He says, no, I put goalkeepers out there to get clean sheets and I get midfielders to do the creative stuff and I want strikers to score goals. This time he said he missed a big one at West Ham and another one here. We were sad and angry at the time, but it also does not help to cry about it. This is the good thing about sport. Nobody cares tomorrow.
I didn't think it was that bad a miss, really. I mean, it was close in, but he hit it okay. That's why, you know, people ask why XG values in the six-yard box are usually lower than they imagine. That's why, because often they don't get scored. On the flip side, that he has only scored 3 of his last 24 clear-cut chances, which is not ideal.
So. Did you see, because a lot of people praise Thibaut Courtois for essentially getting in the way. And Olivier Giroud was caught on the Tele Monte Carlo cameras at half-time, actually kind of praising his opponent, saying, that save on Timo, poof, to Courtois. Courtois replied, all I did was put my foot out like this and had that kind of expression of life. I mean, it's so easy. Well, David, was it so easy?
I mean, he's not done what we talked about before about sort of anticipating where he might be finishing the ball. You know, sometimes you have to be patient and just try and get yourself in the way of the ball. You still have to give him a lot of credit. I mean, it's, you know, even though Werner should score, he's or at least put it in a position where it makes it more difficult save for Courtois, to borrow a cliche. At least he made the keeper work.
Well, that would have been 2-0, but it ended up being 1-1 thanks to Benzema's remarkable kind of overhead piece of opportunism, which was Real Madrid's only shot on target in the entire game. We barely saw the much-feared midfield of Madrid, Modric and Cruz. Was that because of Kante and his continental coverage?
Yeah, I think to some degree. I thought he was very good in that kind of defensive way, as we'd expect. But I thought he had an all-round performance that was just sensational. If anything, it was his attacking contributions that probably caught my eye here. The way Chelsea kind of passed carefully, but also quickly out from the back, often kind of going into the channels a bit more direct, and then it was Kante who was bursting beyond the forwards who were dropping deep. And I thought his footwork, he kind of picked his way through little midfield tangles quite a few times. His pace, I think that's an underrated aspect of his game. He's really quick, and yeah, just an all-round display that I've probably one of the best kind of midfield displays we've seen in the competition this season, and particularly against, you know, we know how much of a strength that area is for Madrid normally, but I thought Madrid's three men in there looked a bit flustered. We saw Casemiro kind of a bit rash on a couple of occasions. I don't think Madrid are used to having that little control. They're not possession totalitarians, but they do like to, you know, keep the play in front of them to some extent, manage the tempo of the game. And I didn't think they could do that against Chelsea.
Kante's kind of relentlessly mis-pigeonholed, isn't he, as a player? I mean, people think, oh, because he won the league with Leicester and, you know, Craig Shakespeare said he could cover all these positions. People focus on the fact that that was a defensive thing. But as Jack said, he's always been really good at attacking. Maurizio Sarri even sort of played him as an attacking midfielder.
Yeah, he never understood that.
But I think you could kind of see why he might have thought that. He may not have done it that well, but his display on Tuesday night, you know, he completed more dribbles than any other player on the pitch. He, you know, as Jack said, he broke the lines. He was the sort of key attacking threat, really. And I think the other thing for me with Chelsea compared to the Lampard era at the start of the season is when you looked at Chelsea's squad at the start of the season, it just looked like they had too many players, like loads of good attacking players, but how would you fit them in? But this system they now play, I looked at the bench at the start of the game and I was like, well, that's a really strong bench, but I don't think anyone has undeservedly missed out. But they get to the second half and they can bring on Ziyech, Kai Havertz and Reece James, and that immediately kind of re-established their foothold in the game. And suddenly, from looking like a sort of jumble of players that don't quite fit together, they now look like, you know, arguably the strongest squad left in the competition.
Arguably the strongest side left in the competition?
Strongest squad left in the competition. Not necessarily, yeah. So I think that in terms of strength and depth, they've probably got more than any other team. Now, they're probably not as good on their day as City and PSG, but, you know, I think assuming they go through, then they're going to be a really difficult opponent for whoever gets through the other ones.
City's bench is pretty strong, Duncan.
I'd still take Chelsea's in terms of versatility and being able to change a game and, you know, switch a game mid-game.
All right, Duncan. I'm backing off. How does this one look for the second leg? Sergio Ramos could be back next week, as may Fulham Mendy, but Marcelo may be missing because, of course, he's been selected to monitor elections to the Madrid Assembly at polling stations. It's the classic. It's up there with kind of rolling your ankle and ACLs.
I mean, that's not that much weirder than the actual position he took up on Tuesday night, I think. Like, we've seen it a few times in La Liga, kind of him roaming infield. And I've been a Marcelo fan for many years, but I don't think this was a great advert for his continued relevance at that level. I thought he looked quite off the pace. And yeah, it seemed to me that he was wandering inside more because he knew he'd get exposed if he had to run back on the outside than anything else.
It's just occurred to me that next week he'll be concerned with making sure people do put crosses in the box as opposed to... Yeah. Anyway, Thomas Tuchel unbeaten in 5 meetings with Real Madrid in the Champions League, the most of any manager in the competition's history. That's remarkable. Are Chelsea going to be okay? Is that 1-1 going to be enough for them? What do you think, David? Duncan?
I mean, you never discount Real Madrid, but I do think that they won't rue the chances. I know people, it's always the old cliche that people, that you will rue your chance if you miss them early on in the game and early on in this tie. But I can't see Chelsea giving up more 2 or 3 goals in this game. Famous last words, obviously, but yeah, just the way that they control games and the way that they've the defence has been so mean. As long as they can keep Benzema quiet, then they should have no problem getting through.
Yeah, I think it's very rare at this stage of a season in the Champions League where you can concentrate on a single player. But Benzema is so much of Real Madrid's goals go through him that yeah, keep him quiet and they should be okay. Mm. We obviously saw Hazard come on late on and, you know, he played one nice ball actually, but it struck me that the Pulisic goal was very much a kind of Eden Hazard style goal really, and you know, he offered a lot more during the game than obviously Hazard did.
Very good. Jack Mantel says, in amongst all the quality football, I think there should be a mention for the referees in the Champions League semi-finals. Excellent performances from McAlee and Brick. You big suck up, Jack Mantel. next up for Chelsea, it's Fulham, while Man City visit Palace and Premier League is next. Also coming up a little bit later on, in a week of really top-level European action, perhaps the most significant continental clash of all.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
Keep listening for Julien Laurent versus James Horncastle in the Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And it's pre-recorded.
Exciting. That Jules at Gym later on in the Intertotally. Duncan, you must be excited as well because you've got your quarterfinal, I think, coming up Monday morning.
That's right, with Sasha, who's, you know, clearly been hiding away, preparing this week. So, yeah, quite worried.
Right, state engineered athlete, I think you described him as previously.
I think that was you.
Duncan's hair, glasses, and polo neck suggest he might be the one doing the engineering.
That's true.
We've all seen Icarus.
Yes, yes. Premier League this weekend, only 5 rounds to go. What's coming up over the next couple of days? Well, Friday, it's Leicester at Southampton with Ian Acho in the starting lineup. Will it be double figures this time? Saturday, Palace play Man City, who could wrap up the title this weekend, depending on what they and Man United do. Relegation could be all but sorted too. Brighton, who are currently 7 points clear of Fulham, will be hosting Leeds, while the Cottagers make the long journey north to Chelsea. Chelsea are in the race for top 4 spots. They are now 3 points clear in 4th place of West Ham, who will be having an all-claret affair on Monday at Burnley. Liverpool, who are 4 points behind Chelsea, will visit Man United on Sunday afternoon. Spurs, who are 5 off Chelsea, host Sheffield United later that day. While Everton, who are 6 points back, but with a game in hand, so kind of still in it, face Aston Villa. Also this weekend, Newcastle Arsenal on Sunday, and the other game on Monday is West Brom Wolves. Now, since our last show, Leicester reinforced their top four chances with that come-from-behind win against Crystal Palace, with the second goal in a 2-1 victory coming 10 minutes from time. What a belter it was from Kelechi Iheanacho. Who was impressed with this?
It was his goal. It was an absolutely remarkable piece of striking. The touch to come inside, and everyone spoke about it after the game, that he shoots before even the defender gets set, before the goalkeeper gets set, and the ball's in the back of the net before both of them even can react. And it is remarkable. And Kasper Schmeichel commented that he was that he does something that he does all the time in training. And it is obviously a confidence issue with him. I think, I mean, you see him after games, and I've played with a lot of Nigerian players with similar character to him. Sometimes you can be too humble. You know, it's always great to be humble, but you can be too humble in those situations and as a footballer. And I think that he just needs that confidence to bring that side out. It's obviously been there inside him all this time. He's on a great run of form, and goals like that just makes you think. It turns everyone's opinion against him. I think a lot of people are just thinking that he was a £25 million flop, and City were right to get rid of him. But you know, if he can continue this, then it's going to be more than money well spent.
Absolutely, the numbers about his form since coming into the Leicester side. He's only the fourth player in Premier League history to reach 10 goals in a season, but only scoring the first of them in February. The other three were all January signings: Tony Yeboah, Papi Cisse, and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He's also one of six Premier League players to have scored more home goals in 2021 than Liverpool. Leicester, anyway, have got a seven-point margin now over the team in fifth, West Ham. They'll be travelling to Saints this Friday. They've got a tough run of games to finish off on this season: Man United, Chelsea and Tottenham, with an FA Cup final against Chelsea thrown in there. But Saints coming up on Friday, and Newcastle after that. Saints, this will be their first visit to St Mary's since a Friday night last season when, you know.
Yeah, the thing we're not allowed to talk about. I mean, 1.2% of Leicester's Premier League goals all time came in that game. I've been thinking about it, and, you know, the ESL has shown us that, you know, to be a big club, you kind of need like a unique brand that's recognised around the world. And sort of thinking Southampton should make losing 9-0 their brand, because they've done it again this season. So if they just do that once a season, that's a pretty attractive thing to bring into any kind of proposed Super League, is to, you know, guarantee at least one team a hefty win. So we'll see.
Work that into a new logo, maybe a motto. 9 is fine.
Yeah. Also, not just a big win, but 9, because you have that kind of nail-biting, will they get
well,
a second digit?
That's the frustrating thing about the game last season, was that Johnny Evans was, you could see him telling the players that 9-0 was the record and they should try and go for 10. And then he missed an absolute sitter. You think Timo Werner's is bad midweek, Johnny Evans missed one from about 3 millimetres off the line. So, I mean, you know, there hasn't been a 10-0 in the... or team scoring 10 goals in the top flight since 1963. So, yeah, maybe it'll happen this week.
Maybe so.
I'll be honest, I don't really care what happens in this game, but what I don't want to see is an emotional Ralph Hasenhüttl at the end of the game. I think this season's almost broke him. From not just the 9-0, I think even the win against Liverpool, his first win against Jurgen Klopp, never, you know, since then he's just been on the verge of tears. It's like I don't know if you remember when you have your first child, and then like you become so emotional that like even adverts start making you tearful. That's what he's become now.
I imagine that Angus Gunn was pretty emotional after conceding those 9 goals in that game, David. It was, I think, his last appearance ever for Saints, poor chap. He's now at Stoke. What was the most goals you ever let in one game?
It's 7.
Oh, what was that like? Take us through them, kind of one by one, your state of mind.
Well, it happened twice, both times at Celtic Park, against Celtic. And the first time I was concussed and I didn't remember it, so that's...
So the first goal goes in, David, and you think, that's a shame, but we're still in this. The second one, you think, yeah, that is a setback. By the third or the fourth, at which point do you cease caring?
it's probably the moment that you start looking at the clock and wishing it would go faster and it actually starts going slower. And you know what makes it worse? At that time, I don't still do it, they used to play goal music. Some dance tune might be like Darude or something like that. And it was like, because as soon as that happened, especially if it happened in the first 10, 15 minutes, then you know it's not going to end well. Luckily for me, though, after I'd left, I think they were beaten 8-0 and 9-0 by Celtic at Celtic Park. Pushed me further down the pecking order anyway. Mm. So.
What year was that, David?
The first time was 1999. Mm-hmm. Don't look it up.
No, I'm looking up something else. right, I think, was it either Kernkraft 4000, I think, which is da-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na-na-na. No, 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 no. Was it that one?
If it was Darude, it was. Was
it that one?
Oh, I don't know what it was.
Or was it Just Can't Get Enough by the Depeche Mode?
But it was like a dance tune.
Yeah, the World Cup samba thing from '98. So when you hear that now, it sends shivers down your spine and a faraway look in your eyes.
I've had therapy now, so I'm totally fine with it now.
All right, then. We'll move on. Elsewhere this weekend, as mentioned, the title race could reach its nail-biting conclusion if United lose and City win. City are at Crystal Palace, who were pretty good on Monday for a team supposedly on the beach, but have only had one victory in their last seven. Man United, meanwhile, host Liverpool Sunday at 4:30. It's the big marquee fixture of this weekend. Do we have high hopes for it, though?
Yeah, it's hard to say with this one, because obviously over the last few years, these two together have had a very strong 0-0 energy. There have been some really dull games between these two. And you sense that Man United wouldn't be overly dissatisfied with that, given the implications for Liverpool. But Liverpool's result at the weekend means they really have to go for this. And I suppose the question is whether that additional desire will lead to a more gung-ho approach, a more open game. You'd hope so. But then, I guess, come back to me when I've fallen asleep on the couch halfway through it.
Well, you never know, Jack. They had that cracking 3-2
you do.
In the FA Cup. All right, you do. United have Roma on Thursday evening. But as Jack points out, Liverpool have to go for it on this one. Throw everything at them. Jurgen Klopp has never won at Old Trafford. Could this be the weekend?
It'll be 0-0. United have drawn 7-0 games 0-0 this season. They're one off their record in a league campaign. Oh, look, they're playing Liverpool. It's just, I think the most excitement will be before the game outside the ground, because there's going to be a big protest. This is the only game I've ever watched projected onto a bedsheet in a pub in Rosham. And there should be some good bedsheet action outside with, you know, slogans scrawled on. But yeah, I can't see...
And two clean sheets inside as well.
Very good, yeah.
David, do you want to put the guys right about this? Let's have some respect for this fixture.
I just think about, Man United-Liverpool is that it just reminds me of the first time that Solskjaer actually got anything right tactically. I think it might have been the first game at Old Trafford against Liverpool when he was in charge, when they went to three at the back and basically just had three central defenders defend the width of the goal and just allowed Liverpool to put crosses into the box and just headed them away. And yeah, it might be the first and only time I've thought that as well, but it's definitely one that sticks out.
Mm. Okay, well, that's coming up 4:30 on Sunday afternoon. Meantime, Liverpool still in the top four picture at the moment. West Ham, though, the nearest competition to Chelsea, they could actually pull level with Thomas Tuchel's side if they win at Burnley on Monday and Chelsea fall at home to Fulham. History's not really on Fulham's side here. They haven't won at Stamford Bridge since, do you know when?
1960-something?
No, it's more recent than that. October 1979, they've only won one of the last 39 meetings, home and away, since then. But then again, Fulham are battling for their top flight survival. And West Brom, who are in a similar predicament, did go to Stamford Bridge and got that remarkable 5-2 victory against Chelsea only the other day. If Fulham did get the win, Brighton are playing Leeds, you know, could it be on?
The only notes I've got here are that Fulham haven't won a London derby in the Premier League since Boyhood came out. One is a long period where not much happens, but you're still emotionally involved. And the other is a Richard Linklater film. So, yeah, I can't see Fulham doing much in this.
I see.
We could all just save everyone a lot of time if we just give Chelsea the 3 points and we see what Scott Parker's wearing and what he says after the game.
Interesting. Scott Parker, by the way, who has been mentioned in context of the Spurs job alongside red-hot favourites Erik ten Hag and Graham Potter. It's an eclectic mix. Spurs themselves are technically in the top four race. They are 5 points behind Chelsea. They'll be hosting Sheffield United. And also worth a mention here, Everton, who are 6 points off Chelsea, but with a game in hand. They host Aston Villa. Spurs against Sheffield United. Sheffield United playing with the pressure off last weekend and getting the 3 points. It was Mourinho against Wilder when they last met these two sides. Now it's Mason against Heckingbottom. Who will it be in charge for Spurs next year?
I just think that they should go for Graham Potter. And if you could give him a side with more attacking intent and with all respect to Brighton players, he's building a good young squad there. But you know, with better and more experienced players, I think he'd do wonders with that Spurs side. I mean, it still remains to be seen how much longer that the likes of Son and Kane will be at the club for. But as it is with the team that they've got now, yeah, I could see them challenging, you know, 3 or 4 places up the table at least.
It would be akin to when Liverpool appointed Brendan Rodgers, and that Swansea, you know, you could see they were playing good football and that he had a lot of good ideas, but a lot of people were like, well, hang on, how does this qualify him for a job as big as Liverpool? But yeah, I agree with David. I think the flip side to that is whether if you've got a player like Harry Kane who's 28 soon and he needs to win stuff in the next few years, whether he'd be willing to sign up to possibly a project that might take a couple of seasons to come to fruition.
Brendan Rodgers, who you mentioned there as a kind of equivalent appointment, of course, was another name that had been heavily linked, certainly in the press, with the Spurs job, but that's all gone a bit quiet. Well, we'll see what happens as we head towards the summer. We'll see as well whether Spurs will find their way into the top four. It does seem unlikely. Everton, 6 off Chelsea, but with a game in hand and a clash with Aston Villa, who are on a rotten run of form. Could they just put themselves back into this mix, do you think?
I think a lot will depend on whether Dominic Calvert-Lewin can get back and properly fit for the rest of the season. I think without him, they do lack a focal point. The defence has been, I think, decent enough, especially away from home. They've been a better away than at home, I think. But Richarlison does need someone to play off in attack. And I think there's only so far you can get kind of swinging balls in to no one. I think they're probably a bit reliant on set pieces and so on. So if Calvert-Lewin can get back in something like the form he showed earlier in the season, they've got a very approachable run in. So not impossible, I'd say, but probably an outside bet.
I mean, they've only won one of their last 9 home games in the Premier League, Everton, which if you look at how close they are to the top four, you think that they're going to end the season with this is a massive missed opportunity rather than, oh, we came close. Mm. This, you know, this is the sort of season you get every few years where the top four does become open, and Everton themselves benefited from that in 2004-05. And this was definitely another opportunity, and given the way they started. But yeah, since the turn of the year, particularly at home, they've just, yeah, looked just brittle and liable to pull out a bad result. And Villa are exactly the sort of team that could go to Goodison and, you know, get their mojo back.
Mm. Although they are competing, Everton, against the Chelsea side who you claim have got the best squad in the Champions League. So, you know, fair enough. I say you claim, I make it sound a bit accusatory, but, you know, clearly a top side. But we'll see what happens this weekend and react to it on Monday. Still to come, other games that are on their way, including Newcastle, Arsenal. But next, a special on this day.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
29th of April, listener, on this day 25 years ago, we have not resorted this. To
that. But I'll tell you, you can tell him now if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
It's only the most famous post-match interview in Premier League history. Kevin Keegan after a win with Newcastle at Elland Road. Newcastle's grip on the title, you know the story. He's asked about Sir Alex Ferguson's suggestions that Nottingham Forest weren't going to try hard against Newcastle because they had a post-season friendly coming up for Stuart Pearce's testimonial and all that.
Say that about a man like Stuart Pearce.
Exactly. And it's nice that, when was that, 1996, is still every bit red hot and current in social media terms.
Yeah, we saw it after Prime Minister's questions this week. It was once again unearthed. The thing that really freaks me out in terms of the passing of time is that Stuart Pearce is now older than Brian Clough was when he retired from football management. So, yeah, relentless.
That is extraordinary. April 29th, by the way, is a biggie in terms of on this day, because it was in April the 29th that also saw the first ever football match to feature numbers on the back of shirts in England. Elsewhere, it had been going on for years in Australia since 1911, in America as well, the United States 1924. But the 1933 FA Cup final between Everton and Man City saw Everton wearing newfangled numbers from 1 to 11, while City went with 12 to 22, which is a very nice way of approaching it. Everton won 3-0, by the way. Oop, Jack.
Just as we've got David on, I want to get his thoughts on what is the next most acceptable number for a goalkeeper after one. Like, for example, in a 23-man World Cup squad, one's gone. What are your two next choices? Because I saw Edouard Mendy for Chelsea wearing 16, and 16 doesn't feel that goalkeeper-y to me.
No, I would say 12 or 13. Most outfield players wouldn't want to wear 13 anyway. Maybe he's the less superstitious about that than they used to be, but 12 or 13, that's it.
David? It's also today, 29th of April, the 30th anniversary of the time fellow former keeper turned media star David Icke appeared on Wogan. Icke, who'd previously been a goalkeeper at Hereford and then a BBC sports presenter to considerable success, appeared on the popular light entertainment chat show Wogan and told the affable host that he was the son of God and that Britain would soon be devastated by tidal waves and earthquakes. Now, why this isn't as present in meme terms as Kevin Keegan's clip is, I don't know. But Icke very much becoming the Matt Letizia of his day there. Coincidentally, he was trending on Twitter this week, David Icke, due to a TV appearance by a sort of Elrond-esque Tony Blair that a lot of people thought confused initially with David Icke, whose hair has kind of grown out. I think a lot of people, David, reacted to that going, well, goalkeepers, they are a funny bunch. Is that fair?
Not anymore. I think you look at a lot of goalkeepers now, they're quiet, boring, studious, which is good. It's exactly what's needed to be a goalkeeper. You don't want a firecracker in your goal, really, do you? To go off in pressure situations.
A Jens Lehmann. So, well, there you go. David Icke. Yeah, I mean, that was such a famous story back in the day, but I suspect he's become a bit of a footnote.
The weird
now.
Thing is that 25 years since Keegan and 30 since Icke, Keegan feels maybe... Not, you know, 20 ago, and the Icke thing feels 35. It's weird right. How it's all compressed.
Well, you see, this is my point. You see Keegan all the time, but this kind of contemporary sports presenter, because that's how most people knew David Icke. He was kind of a BBC football host, suddenly saying, yeah, I am the son of God and calamity is about to visit these islands. And amongst other things about lizards, which was a strong topic for him, doesn't seem to have survived. Maybe, you know, maybe the lizards got to the tapes. I don't know.
You say that, but I read an article about QAnon the other day, and David Icke's name was invoked on two or three occasions. So maybe he's having a resurgence in relevance.
Crikey, I don't want to know about your browsing history, Jack. David, I know you've got to disappear very shortly to do Rochdale things, so let me pose this to you on behalf of listener Ander Itoralde, who says, who have been the three goalkeepers, and they don't have to necessarily be the best three, that David has liked the most this season in the Premier League?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the one that probably everyone would pick out, and that's Emi Martinez. I think that he's been fantastic for Villa this season, and he's... As a goalkeeper, for a goalkeeper in your team, you want him to make a big difference, and he certainly has to them. And I mean, even I had a lot of question marks around him because, you know, even at the age that he is, I think is he 28 now, and he hasn't really had a consistent run in of any kind in sides. And sometimes it's about goalkeeping's about coping with the bad times. So when you have those dips, when you're making mistakes, how do you sort of recover, and we've never really been able to see that from him because he's not been given the chance anywhere. So I've been really impressed with him this season. Another one is Melier at Leeds. I think he's just a fantastic prospect. I mean, looks 12 years old, but he handles situations with so much ease, and his distribution and his calmness under pressure. He'll make mistakes, of course. He's still a young kid, but he's somebody who in 2 or 3 years is just going to be an incredible goalkeeper. And the last one's Robert Sanchez at Brighton, who's actually, he had a season on loan at Rochdale last season. He was here at Rochdale, and obviously they rave about him. The coaches rave about him here, and it was something that I didn't see coming. You know, I thought that Matty Ryan was doing okay, but wasn't setting the world on fire at Brighton. But they made a big decision to bring Sanchez back in, and he's been incredible. I mean, coming for crosses, he just takes the pressure so much off that defence.
Would he have got to Kevin De Bruyne's ball, do you think, if he'd been in goal for Paris Saint-Germain?
No, because I don't think it was a height issue, really.
Okay.
It wasn't a case of that... that Navas didn't come for the ball. There was enough height in the ball for him to make a decision anyway.
All right then, David. All right, well, listen, best of luck then with these remaining two games for Rochdale. And thanks very much for being with us today. Lovely to have you.
Always a pleasure.
Excellent. Next for us, a listener, we are going to move on to one or two more of the weekend's fixtures and then the Intertotally.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
All right, back to the weekend. Brighton Leeds on Saturday at 3:00. As we mentioned, if Fulham get a result at Stamford Bridge, could happen, then Leeds could really reopen the relegation battle here. Monday, then West Brom against Wolves alongside Burnley, West Ham. And by the way, West Ham have had Balbuena's red card rescinded, so he will be available for that game.
The only thing I'm pedantic about is that you don't get the red card rescinded, you get the suspension rescinded.
So thanks.
This red card will stay on his record, so just putting out there.
Doesn't seem right, does it? For those games, though, another iconic Premier League fixture, Newcastle-Arsenal.
Yes, the game that proved that 4-0 is a dangerous lead. To put into context how absurd that match was,
yes,
of Premier League games where a team is led by 4 goals, mm-hmm. the overall record is 0 defeats,
right.
1 draw, I think we know which one, and 718 wins. So,
crikey.
So, yeah, Arsenal, they kind of missed that opportunity, I would say.
Although that has become a bit of a brand, hasn't it? I can't hear Newcastle and Arsenal without thinking of the 4-4, although speaking of the passage of time, it is now 10 years since that game happened. And since then, Newcastle's record against Arsenal is basically losing all the time. They've had 18 games, they lost 16 of them, drawn one and won one.
Well, this is what's one of the things that wasn't really mentioned that much about the you know, the heritage and all the ESL stuff was that you look at the fixture list like this weekend in the Premier League, and it's all the little stories that pop to your mind when you see fixtures. You know, we've got Southampton, Leicester, we've got Newcastle, Arsenal, we've got the horrible outcome eventually of Man United, Liverpool in football terms every time. So these little kind of stories that date back maybe, you know, 10, 20, 50, even 100 years, that's the essence of the game, really.
These foolish things remind me of you. As they head into this clash here, as I mentioned, Newcastle got a terrible record against Arsenal, but when you look at the two sides, Jack, at the moment, the Magpies look like the side with real momentum behind them. They had looked completely down and out. Best case scenario, maybe they'd get a result at Fulham on the final day and sneak staying up. But instead, they're completely out of the relegation picture.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, how transformative an effect one player can have on a team. And I think Alan Saint-Maximin has been that man for Newcastle recently. They just, certain players seem to have within them just some strange, arcane energy that just manages to lift the level of those around them. Obviously, he's a very joyful player as well. He's not, you know, it could be a strong tackling defender who gets the players going, but he tugs at the heartstrings, I think. Even though there aren't fans at the ground, there seems to be just something in the way that they play when he's in the team that makes everyone else believe. Obviously, still major shortcomings with the side, but add one player to the mix and you do realise that they have got others who are capable of being exciting. You know, Almiron can be an exciting player if he's paired with the right partners in attack. And Joe Willock as well, we've seen some important late goals from him. Just a sense of fun and purpose seems to have been just conjured from Saint-Maximin's feet, and yeah, really pleasing to see.
Yeah, Arsenal need perhaps a player to come in like that and lift the spirits, although who knows what they'll do Thursday night when they have their Europa League semi-final against their former manager Unai Emery and his Villarreal. Meantime, music streaming entrepreneur Daniel Ek says he has secured the funds to make a bid for Arsenal and he wants to start talks next week. Kroenke's apparently less keen on that. They say they are 100% committed to the Gunners and are not selling any stake, even though Ek has lined up Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp and Patrick Vieira to be part of his bid. I'm not sure in what capacity. Anyway, all very exciting. Well, we look forward to seeing what happens between Newcastle and Arsenal this time. Allow me to briefly mention that if you sign up for a subscription with The Athletic, you'll get unrivaled coverage on the business end of the season, all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and Q&As with writers, all for just £4 a month. This exceptional offer is available at theathletic.com/totally. And amongst things you can read on The Athletic if you sign up right now are James Horncastle's exclusive interview with Henrik Mkhitaryan, and also, Jack, a lovely piece from yourself, which will be up this weekend, about Ferland Mendy, who you're a major fan of.
Yeah, big fan. Spoke to a couple of his old coaches, and I think he'll be a really important addition to the Madrid side if he's fit to play in the second leg, which I think he will be.
All right, okay. To conclude today's show, then, it's Inter Totally Cup time.
The Inter Totally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. Stadiums might not yet be full, but Paddy's offers are at full capacity. Get a free bet if one leg of your 4-plus bold acca lets you down on all football matches and markets.
T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
OK, then, moments away from another dramatic quarter-final in the Inter Totally. So far, we've seen Michael Cox defeat Matt Davis Adams. Michael will now face the winner of Monday morning's clash between Duncan Alexander and Sasha Gurionov. Woof. The other side of the draw, well, last Monday, saw Benji Laniado putting out Jack Lang on a tiebreaker. Benji has gone into the semi-finals, but who will he be facing there? Let's meet the contestants.
Paris born and Paris bred, he is the PS genius. Ooh la la, missus, it's Julien Laurent.
Jules, thank you for that classy tribute to Jim Steinman.
Thank you for having me.
No, not at all, not at all. Jules, This is big. You're in the quarterfinals. This is where it ended for you, of course, last year in the Intertotally. Yeah. In classic Parisian fashion, you know, quarterfinal exit. Yeah. But now facing somebody you know really well, and I think I'm right in saying there's a certain amount of needle in this one.
It's like playing like against a brother, and you know you always really? Want to be your brother, but it always hurts when you do, and that's very much like it feels like today.
Crikey. Okay, it's going to be an emotional contest this then. Can we just check on your charity and wager, should you prove the winner?
My charity is Dementia UK, again, very close to my heart. And my bet would be that Juventus won't qualify for the Champions League next season.
Ooh.
They won't finish top four.
I see. All right. Let's meet the man between you and a semi-final.
And his opponent. Every encounter with him is hairy, but come hull or high water, you can depend on his expertise to come to the fore. He is James Horncastle. Bacon man
is bacon bread. All right, laid back with James Horncastle. James, how are you feeling ahead of this one against your brother Jules?
Laid back. You know, I can't lose to Jules. You know, our friendship will remain. So, right. You know, I think I'm taking the Carlo Ancelotti approach that this, yes, it's a high pressure occasion, mm-hmm. but yeah, I'm just going to go out there and do my best quizzing.
Right. And let quizzing be the real winner, I think. Mm. Neither of you made it past the quarterfinals last year, so this is going to be huge. James, can I just check on your charity and wager?
So my charity is Reporters Without Borders. And my wager, James, is that Chelsea will win the Champions League.
Huge. Let's get our quiz on. Jules, you're up first. Here comes question one. At the 2018 World Cup, who scored Belgium's late winner as they came from 2-0 down to beat Japan in the last 16?
Nasser Chadli.
Is correct. Question two. When Leicester City won the Premier League in 2015-16, they did so with a player on loan from Swansea in their squad. Who was he?
Nathan Dyer.
Is correct. Question three. Who was the last footballer to win the Ballon d'Or while playing in France?
Jean-Pierre Papin.
Is correct. Question four. Gabriel Batistuta played for Fiorentina, Roma and which other Serie A club? Batty goal. We remember him at Florence. Won the title at Roma. Which other Serie A club did he turn out for?
Yeah, I know it. I know it. I know it. Genoa.
No, it really, really wasn't Genoa. It was Inter. Oh. Okay. 3 out of 4 so far for you, Jules, as we go to question five. With which club did Giovanni Trapattoni win the Portuguese league title in 2005?
Benfica.
Is correct. A very respectable 4 out of 5 for you there, Jules. How do you feel?
I feel good, but that Batistuta, I almost said Inter, and then I thought, no, I could not see him in that shirt, so I just went really rogue, thinking like, could have gone there really late in his career. So, wow. But pretty happy. There was some tricky one. I don't want to say that, you know, sometimes this game is fixed, but I hope that his questions is as hard as mine. That's what I'm saying. And I want to see both his hands, right?
Right.
Because we know that, you know, in Italy, we know what happens with cheating.
Okay, we're on a Zoom call, everybody. We can see exactly what's going down here. All right, James Horncastle, here comes your first question. What is your favourite colour? Sorry, no.
What's your mother's maiden?
It's got to be blue, James. Got to be blue. Right. Question two.
Question two. Clearly, having a bit of fun. Anyway, question one then. Which is the least populous nation to ever appear at the World Cup finals?
Honduras?
Nope. The answer is Iceland. Made their debut at the 2018 World Cup. Question two. When Leicester City won the Premier League in 2015-16, they only lost 3 games, but one team beat them twice. Which team was that?
Arsenal.
Is correct. Question three. Who was the last player to win the Ballon d'Or while playing in England?
Cristiano?
Is correct. You're on 2 out of 3. From which club, question 4, from which club did Barcelona sign Luis Figo?
Sporting.
Is correct. Question 5, and this to pull level with Julien and force a tiebreak. With which club did Luis van Gaal win the Eredivisie in 2009?
That would be AZ Alkmaar.
Oh, my word, he's done it. Astonishing show of knowledge there. After that that misstep in the first question, he comes back strong, he comes back hard, and he has forced a tiebreaker. Jules, crikey, you thought you had that. But now I must put to you and James a question of numbers, and I'm going to ask you both to text me your reply. The person with the closest answer will be taking that spot in the semi-finals against Benji Laniardo. Okay, so the tiebreaker question is, how many goals in total were scored in the 2019-2020 Premier League season? How many goals in total were scored in the 2019-2020 Premier League season? You text or WhatsApp me your answers. Okay, I've had James's answer.
He's Googling. Jules is Googling.
I've just sent mine.
So, I've had both of your answers. James Horncastle has said 1,600. Julien Laurens has gone for 1,120. The answer for the number of total goals scored in the 2019-2020 Premier League season is 1,034. Jules, you're in the semi-final.
Oh, congratulations, Jules.
Thank you. Thank you to my fans, my family, you know, my parents. 1,600 goals. What league did you think that was? That's like... Do you know
he's
how many
used
games
to Serie A.
Oh, yeah. You thought about... Yeah.
Well, James, it's a huge blow to lose you. A magnificent performance there in on these questions after that difficult beginning. But Jules, congratulations. And looking forward to seeing how you get on against Benji Laniardo.
Felicitations, as they say in Paris, Julien. You're through to the semi-finals of the Intertotally Cup. And Jules' bet that Juve will finish outside the top four in Serie A is priced at 17-10 at paddypower.com or on the Paddy Power app. Odds are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only, and please gamble responsibly.
Wow, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? It's really whipped up my enthusiasm for Monday morning's clash, Duncan, featuring you.
I mean, whether it's Intertotally or the Champions League, you often get some of the best ties in the quarterfinals. You know, often the finals can be a damp squib. So, yeah, I mean, just hope me and Sasha can live up to that, really, and not do a sort of nil-nil, you know, bleak aggregate.
If it was nil-nil, it would go to a tiebreaker. And just to say, while Jules and James were struggling there, you nailed that tiebreaker question. That's very much your ace in the hole.
I suspect that wouldn't have been a tiebreaker for me. I don't know. I would have gladly taken it, yeah.
Right. OK, well, that's coming up on Monday, along with our reaction to all of the weekend's action. And a little look forward to the semi-final second legs coming up next week. For now, that's it. So many thanks to Jack and to Duncan and to the now off doing goalkeeping things, David Priest. And you, listener, thanks ever so much. We'll see you Monday morning, I hope. Have a great weekend. From all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.